Hi, and welcome back to Ye Olde Guide. Now, I listen to a fair number of current affairs podcasts, and it's fair to say the episodes have a certain shelf life. On Ye Olde Guide, we assume our episodes about historical elements of towns have a relatively long shelf life. But when we recorded our episode on Windsor and Eton in early September 2022, we had no idea that its most famous resident, Queen Elizabeth II, would pass away on September the 8th. The history of Windsor is entwined with the history of the English and British monarchy, as we discover in this episode. And so it was for Queen Elizabeth. The late Queen lived as a child in the Royal Lodge in Windsor, and she made the first of her historic wartime broadcasts on October the 13th, 1940, from inside Windsor Castle. That was for the BBC's Children's Hour. The Queen lived inside Windsor Castle permanently during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, in the so-called HMS bubble. On Monday the 19th of September 2022, the funeral for the late Queen put the eyes of the world on Windsor, as the Queen's coffin was driven from Wellington Arch in central London, through the streets of West London and the Berkshire countryside, and finally along the Long Walk in Windsor, up towards Windsor Castle. The route was lined with thousands. In Windsor, the state hearse travelled in procession to St George's Chapel, where a committal service took place and the Queen was laid to rest alongside her late husband, Prince Philip. History is a continuous process, and so it is for our towns and their residents, whether ordinary or famous. We considered re-recording this episode, but in the end, we thought it would be nice evidence of just how quickly history can be made. So in this episode, we do talk about the late Queen, and we mention Prince, now King, Charles a few times. Furthermore, we mention the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. Yes, Britain gained a new Prime Minister and a new head of state within a week. Quite remarkable. Boris also has a major association within this episode, by the way. So please forgive us for these possibly disorientating references, and we hope you enjoy our historical guide to Windsor and Eton. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Ye Olde Guide, your podcast guide exploring the history and heritage of the towns and cities of England. And today we have a right royal treat for you. A town steeped in its history of 1,000 years of monarchical power. We are bringing you a historical tour of Windsor. My name is Liam McGrath, and I am delighted to introduce a man who certainly knows his Henrys, his Edwards, his Williams and Elizabeths. It's King of the Podcast Castle, historian Daniel Gooch. Welcome back to the show, Daniel. How are you?
Thank you. That's quite an introduction. I'm very well. So, big news for me. My son was born and called him Alfred. That's another good royal name there.
Did you name him after the king or another Alf?
It wasn't my choice, but I'm quite happy. To England's two greatest leaders, Alf Ramsey and Alfred the Great.
I was going to say Alf Ramsey. I thought that was a direct.
Absolutely, yeah. I wasn't objecting.
Well, that's very exciting news. Congratulations. And therefore, thank you for making it back to the podcast. I hope you're getting enough sleep. And
I hate to be one of those parents who bangs on about how little I've slept. I'm quite tired, let's put it that way, in general.
If you're not up in the middle of the show, we'll wake you up.
I've had an espresso. I'm fine now. The children are asleep.
Well, thanks to all of you who tuned into our last episode, which was Hull, which we enjoyed very much. And I'm sorry, we didn't mention the inventor of the Venn diagram, John Venn, who was born in Hull. Don't know how we missed that, but it doesn't matter because he did most of his work in Cambridge, which we'll be visiting in an upcoming episode.
Excellent.
Spoiler alert, there's a lovely stained glass window. A few weeks' time, that one. But that omission got me thinking, if there was a Venn diagram with Hull and Windsor, what would be in the overlap? Putting you on the spot here.
thinking that myself. Did we talk... Well, I suppose we spoke about Edward the First for Hull, didn't we? We talked about some of his descendants in this episode.
What's the King's Town?
We must have mentioned trains in Hull. We mentioned trains in all the episodes.
We always mentioned.
Civil War. No cloth trade today, though, unfortunately.
There was a Venn diagram of all our episodes. I don't know how many circles you're allowed in the Venn diagram, but I think trains and Civil War and maybe cloth feature in all of them.
I think they would. I think that's right.
So this episode is very different from the last one. Relatively small, touristy, dare I say, posh town visiting this time compared to some we've covered, certainly compared to Hull. And we will be exploring Windsor in five categories, just to look at things from different perspectives. And for added fun, we will be giving the town a score for interest and appeal in each category. Let's start with an overview of Windsor.
Windsor is a fairly small town in Berkshire, west of London, with a population of about 33,000. Now, our focus today is specifically the town of Windsor and not the nearby village Old Windsor. Quite confusingly, they used to be known as New Windsor, the town we're interested in, and Windsor, what is now Old Windsor, respectively. And Old Windsor is, by several centuries, the oldest settlement. It was founded in the 7th century, but it's about 2 miles from Windsor, so they can't really be considered part of the same town. We are, however, going to look at Windsor's very near neighbour, Eton, too, which has a population of about 5,000 and is most well known for its famous public school, Eton College. The reason we're going to incorporate Eton is that although they are separate towns, and they were historically even in different counties, separated just across the border that the River Thames forms, they're only separated by a small footbridge over the river, so are effectively one single conurbation. Or to put
they feel like the same place, don't they? I mean, if you're visiting, you just walk from one into the other without really knowing.
Exactly. If you're going to visit Windsor, you're going to go to Eton as well. But talking about Windsor's origin, Windsor's most famous probably as an official residence of the Queen through its castle, and the area's royal connections do go back a very long way. Old Windsor was the site of Saxon royal residences. Edward the Confessor and early Norman monarchs held great councils there in the 11th century. And at this time, Eton was established as a small settlement, but modern-day New Windsor was probably covered by forest. But this totally changed around 1070 when William the Conqueror, who had come into personal ownership of the land on which Windsor now sits, built the first wooden castle on the site of the current castle. Shortly after this, a new town sprang up around the castle as a kind of, you might say, suburb around the castle's walls. Now, the town of New Windsor, or Windsor as I'm going to call it from now on, was largely established around this small settlement in the 12th century as a Plantagenet plan town after the Civil War, the anarchy between Stephen and Matilda, which we've talked about quite a lot in other episodes. The castle was later made a formal royal residence in the 14th century by King Edward II. And as well as being the location for many important royal and state events, this royal patronage of Windsor Castle and also Eton College, which was founded by Henry VI in the 1440s, resulted in the town's main economic strengths ever since: service and tourism. Now, Windsor's economy, and to some extent Eton's, was reliant on tourism as far back as the 15th century, when pilgrims came to visit shrines and relics in St George's Chapel within the castle complex and at Eton College itself. And this strong tourist trade lasted more or less until the Reformation. And following this, Windsor went through a bit of a downturn. It became quite poor and dilapidated over the next few hundred years. But this changed, as is so often the way, when the railway lines were connected to Windsor from 1844. There wasn't a great deal of mass industrial expansion at this time, but Windsor became once again a hugely important royal and therefore at the time political centre, as it became Queen Victoria's primary location for receiving foreign leaders. The town of Windsor itself also underwent significant rebuilding at this time, and Eton became primarily a service town, with most of the town's buildings being set up as businesses to serve Eton College. And today, the town's once again draw bucket loads of tourists and are famous for the same two things that have been for centuries: famous public school of Eton College, the tourist magnet of Windsor Castle, and also a more recent addition, the very first Legoland built outside Denmark.
Three very good reasons to go to Windsor and Eton. And I think it's also fair to say a very pretty and pleasant town centre environment as well. We first category in the podcast is politics and war. Let's start with the castle. Now, we've heard about some impressive castles on this podcast. I'm thinking back to Lincoln, Lancaster, Colchester. But Windsor's probably the one that's got the most royal and political connection so far.
The cast is going to be central to a lot of this podcast. So we're going to kind of separate it out. We're going to talk about the structure and the physical, you know, manifestation and layout of the castle and history of the structure later. But for the moment, we are, as you said, going to concentrate on its uniquely significant function as a royal residence, because it's been an official residence of the monarch going back to the 14th century, about 500 years before Buckingham Palace ever was, and centuries before Buckingham Palace was ever built. And it really does have a completely unmatched history in hosting royal state occasions. As well as being the largest occupied castle in the world, it's also been occupied continuously for longer than any other castle or palace in the whole of Europe. So its history is incredibly rich and deep. And the royal family today even has derives its surname from Windsor. This stems from 1917, during the First World War, when King George V, the current Queen's grandfather, wanted to eschew the German connections of the official royal house name of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, which he'd inherited from Prince Albert, Queen Victoria's consort, not least because there was a German aeroplane called Gotha G4 going around bombing London at the time. So he took the vastly more British sounding Windsor as a surname for his family and included the castle's round tower in the new badge of the House of Windsor. And it's actually it was the first time ever that a monarch had actually had a surname. Before that, they'd just been known by their regnal name. So it's a very unique royal link there for Windsor.
And it seems sensible to me. I mean, they had to change the name, really, didn't they? I guess there's not many Vladimirs born this year, is there?
That's true, yes. Certain names do go out of fashion.
Tell us a bit more about the royal family and their various connections at the castle.
If I sat here with a list of all the royal weddings, state visits, prisoners, births, councils, conferences held in Windsor Castle, we'd be sitting here for hours. So
we would.
Can't even try, but we'll pick out some of the most interesting ones for flavour. First, many kings, monarchs, nobles have been held captive in Windsor Castle. Notable ones are James I of Scotland, when he was captured by pirates and held as hostage by English King Henry IV. Charles d'Orléans, the famous poet of the Hundred Years' War. Notable deaths have occurred here too. Prince Albert, who we mentioned earlier, consort of Queen Victoria. The room in which he died was turned into a shrine by the notoriously grief-stricken Queen. And quite interestingly, Prince Alfonso, who was the oldest son of Edward I, which meant we never got to have a King Alfonso, which would have been quite an interesting name.
A great name for a king.
Yeah, assuming he wouldn't have changed it, of course, which does sometimes happen. Notable births in Windsor Castle include Edward III, who was subsequently known for a time just as Edward Windsor, and Henry VI. Another major royal event is Henry VIII supposedly first saw Anne Boleyn in Windsor Castle, which, of course, kickstarted his divorce from Catherine of Aragon and ultimately England's break from the Roman Catholic Church. So there's a little seed of a hugely important political event there. And one final interesting point is that because the castle is the Queen's residence, she chooses to pay council tax on it, which is like the UK's local property tax. The amount she pays in a year is just over £2,000 because of the oddities of our banding system. So it's not a great deal more than I have to pay down the road in Reading. So
do you know what struck me, though, when I was reading about the Windsor Castle, right? It struck me throughout history that the monarchs have their peculiar tastes on it. I mean, some of them absolutely loved it. You mentioned Henry VIII. Apparently he loved it. He would go hunting, have great parties there. And you mentioned some of the builders, but not actually popular with Queen Victoria, despite the fact that she centred much of her life and diplomatic life there. She didn't actually like it. She described it as like a prison.
Well, she had a lot of options, didn't she? I think she probably preferred Osborne House, Isle of Wight, and going up to Scotland when she could.
She probably liked the seaside. But I'm pleased to say Elizabeth II, she does like it, and she used it as a weekend retreat.
Well, I wouldn't say no to it either.
But Prince Charles doesn't like it, too noisy, and there are a lot of aeroplanes flying over it. Do you want to say anything more about monarchs?
We'll talk about just very quickly some of the other royal buildings from Windsor.
Yes,
because there are some others. There's the 17th century Royal Lodge in Windsor Great Park. That's been home to several monarchs, more recently the Queen Mother and currently Prince Andrew and his family. Also the Frogmore Estate, which is right next to the castle. This contains Frogmore Cottage, which was built originally for George III's wife, Queen Charlotte, in 1801. And also the Royal Mausoleum, which holds the graves of Queen Victoria and her husband, Prince Albert. It's been closed for structural repairs since 2007, unfortunately, but I think it is due to reopen next year, in case you ever want to pop in and see the tombs.
We'll talk a bit now, politics and war. We're going to talk about wars. Now, it's a very sedate town now, but was this massive castle ever engaged in any sort of military action?
It was, yeah. As you're right, we tend to think of it as a domestic place, a great palace, a royal residence, but it was initially built as a military stronghold, as well as all these great royal family and state occasions. It has seen some military action over the years. We can talk about Prince John, Bad Prince John from Robin Hood, his rebellion against Richard I before he became King John. He laid siege to the castle in 1193 as part of this rebellion against his brother King Richard when the king was away, as famously he tended to be quite a lot. John did manage to capture the town, but it was retaken by nobles led by the Archbishop of Rouen, who was Constable of Windsor following a 2-month siege. So Prince John didn't do very well out of it. And he later suffered the same fate himself, actually, in the First Barons' War, which was rebellions against now King John. It's a slightly forgotten invasion of England by Louis, the heir to the French throne, which we covered a bit more in our episode on Lincoln.
I was going to say, it's not been forgotten by this podcast.
No, absolutely not.
Lincoln episode.
But Windsor was important as well as Lincoln in this war, because when Louis invaded in 1216, initially only two castles, Dover Castle and Windsor Castle, held out against the invaders. The defending forces, about 60 knights, survived a 2-month siege. And it was during the siege that the Western Curtain Wall, which still exists today, was constructed. We can move on now to the Second Baron's War. John's son, Henry III, also faced rebellions just before the war started. He held an important conference at Windsor in 1263. Henry agreed to surrender the castle to the barons who were rebelling, but he failed to do so. That resulted in the capture of the castle by the rebel leader, the famous Simon de Montfort, after a short siege. And Henry was actually held captive at Windsor Castle later during the Second Baron's War, after the Battle of Lewes, so it certainly wasn't a happy place for him either, just like his father, King John. Next, we have the Civil War. An old favourite of the guide. It's notable here that despite Windsor's royal links, the town was pretty fervently parliamentarian and was a home of the New Model Army, the parliamentarian fighting force. The royalists did try to take Eton during the war, and they did manage to occupy Eton College, but they couldn't take Windsor, so they gave up and retreated. Aside from the constant presence of soldiers in the town itself during the war, one other impact on the area was the constant poaching of the many deer in the Royal Forest at Windsor actually wiped out the whole population of deer there for a time. It had some kind of environmental impact. And then after the war, many high-ranking royalist prisoners were held in Windsor, including, briefly, captured King Charles I a few weeks before he was executed.
Oh dear. So not a happy place for him.
Not at all. But more happy for William III, for a final military anecdote. During the Glorious Revolution, William III lodged here for 4 days during his invasion of England. So happier memories for him.
Absolutely. Now, we covered the Glorious Revolution in the Reading episode, didn't we? The Venn diagram. joining places up through conflict. So you've listed 4 quite significant periods of English military history there.
Yep.
So quite a lot of action. And generally, I'd say that it was seen as a real stronghold, a place that monarchs felt safe. And that military connection goes on today. If you visit Windsor and you're there at the right time of day, I think at 11 o'clock in the morning, you'll see the changing of the guard.
You absolutely will, where the ceremony where the soldiers protecting the castle are replaced by a new batch of soldiers protecting the castle. And there's actually been a daily guard at Windsor since the mid-17th century, and it's been a garrison town pretty much since the Civil War. We mentioned this earlier, but 300 soldiers were stationed here in 1660, which made the town, as it was at the time, pretty overcrowded. And the soldiers haven't always been that welcome in Windsor. There was one visitor in the 1780s who describes having to sleep above a raucous and vulgar bar full chiefly of soldiers and low fellows, which shows you what he thought of them, really. But there is a kind of a more highbrow garrison connected with Windsor in the form of the Household Cavalry. The Household Cavalry is part of the Queen's official bodyguard and comprises the two most senior regiments in the army. The connections here are, first, the Household Cavalry Museum Archive is in Windsor. This is really a research centre because the main museum is in London. But the cavalry also has a training wing in Windsor at Combermere Barracks, and one of its regiments was based in the town until 2019. So a few strong connections there from the Household Cavalry.
Absolutely. So let's move on to the other side of English government, British government, and that's the politicians. And Eton College has produced a huge number of British prime ministers, amongst other people. I think it's produced 20 British prime ministers. Let's talk a bit about Eton College and its role in political life in the country.
To give a bit of background on Eton College's founding, it was founded by Henry VI, whose statue still stands in the schoolyard, in the 1440s for 25 poor and indigent scholars. So initially it had a trend of educating children of the poor as well as those of the wealthy. And that hasn't entirely carried on today because it, as an all-boys and all-boarding school, it charges about £50,000 per year. So not a cheap place to go. When the school was founded initially, the town of Eton immediately became a giant building site. It was full of workmen, masons, materials. But the school did grow a great reputation for centuries after its construction. Daniel Defoe in the early 18th century called it the finest school for what we call grammar learning. We'll talk a bit more about its cultural and urban legacy later on. But in this category, we just need to mention its plethora of important political alumni. There are lots and lots of them. At the very top would be John Maynard Keynes, multiple prime ministers, as you mentioned, including the Duke of Wellington, the current Prime Minister Boris Johnson, Robert Boyle, numerous kings from around the world. If you want to see more, the full list, you won't struggle to find the list online, but it's a stunning number of prime ministers and politicians, certainly.
Certainly is, and two in the last decade, and David Cameron and Boris Johnson. So it's quite an extraordinary school, and whatever you think about the concentration of power as a result of the school, it is something, a set of buildings that you can walk through. So look, I think we have talked a lot there about politics and war, and it's time to think about the score we're going to give Windsor.
First thing to say is we've really only scratched the surface of all the notable royal events that have happened here. Politically and militarily, Windsor and Eton have both had significant events. You might just possibly nitpick that it can be hard to point to one particular battle, council or parliament, which in itself changed British history. But come on, let's be honest, if we'd found just one of these events in any of the other towns we've covered, we'd probably build this entire section of the podcast around it. And same with Eton College's list of alumni. We can't start to do justice to the list due to its extent, so we always need to keep that in mind. So the only question for me really is in how this is celebrated. Windsor Museum is quite small. It doesn't really cover the nationally significant events. It's more of a local history museum. So we're left with, if that's the appropriate word, it probably isn't completely fair, but we'll go with it. The changing of the guard, the military parades in the town itself, and the castle, which is open to the public if you're willing to pay. One thing I'd note about the castle is it's specifically a royal residence and chapel that you are visiting. And it's not like, say, the Tower of London, a museum of all the interesting people and events that have happened here. It's not a political and military museum. But this isn't necessarily a bad thing if you're interested in the structure itself, in art history and how royalty lived, and a bit of an alternative to things you might be seeing alternatively in London. Eton itself does have a few small museums, but they're hardly ever open, like once, I think, for about 2 hours per week on a Sunday or something. So I'm basically going to discount them. But it's still a great score. It perhaps just for this minor nitpick of a lack of celebration of significant events, I'm not going to give it a perfect 10, but I'm going to go very close. I'm going to give Windsor and Eton a 9.
I'm also going to give it a 9. I don't think you'll find such a concentration of history of the British monarchy, and it's sort of celebrated through the architecture of that building. I mean, I take your point that what's inside is mostly art, you know, it's artworks that are owned. You've got Queen Mary's doll's house, but I suppose you could look at each of the phases of the building of the castle or the refurbishment of the castle over the ages, and that reflects the mood of the era, the mood of the monarch or the governments at the time, and it has been at the heart of political life in this country, even in modern times, even though royal power is nothing like it was some of the most significant events in public life in Britain are still held there. One centre of our of British cultural life, and I think that there's few other places there where it's celebrated in quite such an obvious fashion. So for me, it's a 9.
Excellent. That's one of the best scores any place has got. 18 out of 20 for politics and war.
Our second category is science and industry. As I said earlier, we try to explore towns from different perspectives through these categories. We wouldn't expect much industry in Windsor compared to some of the places we visited, but we do have loads of tourism. We've kind of touched on this. If you go there today, there is no end of tourist tat shops. So, Daniel, would you agree that's the primary industry, if that's the word to use?
I think I would, yes. I mean, historically, there's been very little mass industrialisation in Windsor or Eton. It's probably worth talking about why that is. It's really because of the town's location. They couldn't expand into the Crown lands of Home Park or Windsor Great Park to the south and west, or into the lands that Eton College owned to the north. And what land remained in the middle has historically been quite prone to flooding. So it was very difficult to build large factories or lots of homes historically in those areas. This was noted quite early in the industrialised period by Daniel Defoe, who said of Windsor, "And now I am come by just degrees to Windsor, where I must leave talking of trade, river, navigation, meal and malt." Well, he did go on to say very nice things about the castle, so he wasn't damning the place. So the town's economy has really come to be based, as you rightly said, on tourism. And this has its origins in the pilgrimages that used to be made from the 15th century to shrines and relics in St. George's Chapel and Eton College, which is reflected in the explosion in the number of inns in the town at this time. People weren't just going for the religious experience. They needed to be put up, they needed to eat, they needed to drink, and Windsor in particular certainly catered for them. And this tourist industry persisted until the Reformation, when relics and shrines were mostly abandoned. But along with financial services, tourism has become once more the significant component of Windsor's modern economy. It probably also has to be said the place is a bit of a commuter town. In modern times, mainly with London and the Thames Valley, but also throughout the 20th century, particularly with new employment opportunities that opened up in nearby Slough just after the First World War. So you've always had people living there, working elsewhere, but certainly within the town itself, tourism has been very important and continues to be to this day.
It's very centrally located, very close to London and Heathrow Airport. Once again, a tourist place, but for different reasons. People aren't going to see a relic of the True Cross anymore. They're going to see the castle, changing of the guard, and buy a plate with the Queen's head on it, or a Prince William ruler.
A different form of relic.
Such things. Do you know I am the proud owner of a Charles and Diana wedding cheese cutter?
I'm just astonished that you've got that.
I did not buy it at Windsor. I bought it for 50p from a bric-a-brac place in Stowmarket, I think. 50p. Well, it's very good at cutting things.
I assume it was second-hand. People aren't still manufacturing them.
lots of tourism in Windsor. There are some other connections to science, and it is celebrated in a small way in the Windsor Museum, and that's airmail.
Absolutely. Windsor does have a pretty intriguing connection to airmail. First, because the first airmail service in the country flew between Windsor and Hendon for a few months in 1911 as part of George V's coronation celebrations. This didn't last particularly long, just a few months, but there is a second connection, which exists to this day, which is that Windsor has the only remaining dedicated airmail letterbox in the country, situated right outside the castle. And unlike the traditional red letterboxes, these were, and this one that remains is, painted blue. They were originally set up for airmail in the 1930s, and all the rest of them have now been withdrawn or painted red, but Windsor sits there remaining in its original blue. Unfortunately, the postbox doesn't take letters anymore, so it's only for show. It's been sealed up with along with the red post box that sits beside it because of the threat of terrorism. But it's still there to look at and take photos of if you're interested in it.
And a good reminder of a service that's gone by, and it is mentioned in the museum. So this is quite a brief category, I think, almost inevitably. I don't think there's any shame in that for Windsor. It's not an industrial town or city like some we've visited. There's definitely less to say in this category. Some interesting bits there on airmail, but for me, it's got to be a fairly low score. It's got to be a 2.
2 from Liam. I think you're right. It doesn't necessarily have to be the town's strength, and you could probably imagine that if Windsor were some great 19th century brick-built industrial town, it would be, the town would have a very different character today from what it does. Ultimately, there's not a lot to say here. I'll give some credit for the interesting airmail point because it does include a remnant and it is mentioned in the museum. A little more credit for some of the scientific alumni of Eton, which you can look up as the great 17th century chemist Robert Boyle being chief among them. But it's not going to be particularly high. For me, it's going to be a 1.5.
We're going on to our third category now, arts and culture. And I think it's time to go back to Eton College.
This time to talk about its role in the foundation of organised sport in Victorian times. This is most obviously evident in two pretty obscure sports. The Eton Wall Game, which is, it's like a very primitive form of playground rugby, which is only played in almost all situations at Eton College. And Eton Fives, which is like squash, played with your hands on a bizarre-looking court, which is modelled on the wall of Eton College Chapel, complete with a small buttress poking out of the side of the court. We used to have those at our school, if you remember, Liam.
Ever play fives, Daniel? Did you ever get into that?
I never played fives. I never had a fives glove. Never joined the fives club.
Do you have to wear gloves? I never realised.
You do, yeah. Special gloves.
You whack the thing with your hand, raw hand. I didn't realise there was protection.
Absolutely. There are other versions of fives which I think don't use gloves, but I think the Eton version particularly does.
But the buttress is pretty fascinating. Distinguishing feature is this stone buttress.
Yeah, I think the only state school in the country which has one is in Norwich.
That's why they're so hopeless at football up there.
Must be.
But there's much more, isn't there? Of the role of Eton in sport, organised sport.
Yes, on much, much more popular and less obscure sports. Eton had a key role in the early development of organised forms of football, really helping take football away from the famous old intervillage medieval mob format of a game. Started to record some of our earliest descriptions of football in the college. People at the college started to codify rules of the game and specifically started to devise rules that concentrated on kicking. The kicking element was very specific to Eton and obviously forms the origins of football as we play it now. Football previously had various other ways it could be played. Other public schools like rugby famously chose to play with their hands, hence the name rugby. I mean, if Eton had followed the same rule, we could be now calling football Eton rather than football.
Which that is, would be strange.
It would be, yeah. I suppose FIFA would be called UEFA, the FA would be called the EA. It would be a very strange parallel universe.
So why did this happen in Eton?
A lot of the reason it happened was because Etonians in the 19th century had more kind of influence to spread their ideas and their pastime than most people. But also because people who went to Eton were wealthy, they had more time to devote to such things. In the mid-19th century, poor people, including children, usually had to work and couldn't devote time to properly organised sport like the wealthy could. But I don't think we should let this detract in any way from Eton's importance to football. The evidence of some of the organised forms of football at Eton stretch as far back as the 16th century, and the earliest known rules for the game of any type were written there in 1815. This is football when I say earliest known rules, I mean earliest known rules for football overall, not just the earliest known rules for the game that was played at Eton. And one of the earliest known organised football matches between different teams happened in 1834 between Eton and Harrow School. And as the game spread in popularity, the Eton alumni team, Old Etonians, had quite a bit of success. They won the FA Cup twice. They reached the final 6 times in total between 1875 in 1883, and were in fact the last amateur team to win the Cup in 1882. So, yeah, Eton's had a big influence on the origins, the codification of football, and also its alumni have had some decent success in it, albeit a long time ago.
For our American listeners, of course, we are talking about soccer. Could have been called Eton Ball.
There's some parallel universe where rugby is called handball and they're having exactly the same conversation about, imagine if it had been called rugby.
And there's more sports.
There is. A couple of Olympic links here. Most recently, the UK won its first gold medal of the 2012 Olympics, the women's coxless pairs, at the very close by Dorney Lake, which was called Eton Dorney. Oh. For the Olympics, which hosted rowing and sprint canoeing. This may be the first time on the podcast I'm able to talk about something I actually witnessed. I popped down there for one of the days, took the bus down from Slough outside the station.
Yeah, and that was... were you there for the coxless pairs? I assume coxless pairs means that they haven't got the woman or the man shouting at the front of the boat.
Yeah, they have to steer themselves, keep their own rhythm.
No shouting. I always thought that was a great job, being the cox.
You have to be quite small though.
I am relatively small.
I think you have to be even smaller than you are.
I'll get my application in. Seems like a good job to me. Shout at people. Yeah. And not do any rowing.
And get a medal as well. I think the youngest ever Olympic medalist was a five-year-old boy at the Paris Olympics in the 1904, 1900 maybe. Things are going back that far. We can talk about the 1908 Olympics as well.
I think we should.
Connection. The 1908 Olympic marathon started in the grounds of Windsor Castle. And the route went down through Eton and Slough, through the western suburbs of London, finishing at the White City Stadium in West London. And there is still one physical remnant of this in Eton. There is a route marker left on a house on Eton High Street showing 25 miles to go, which couldn't have been very encouraging if you just started. And you can find that quite near the post office, near the bridge there. It's the only route marker from the marathon that still remains. So something quite unique to Eton.
I think now we should mention, perhaps bizarre for the cultural section, but let's mention Legoland.
Yeah, we'll talk about Legoland. I think along with the castle, it's probably the one thing that's most likely to draw tourists to Windsor. It's the most visited theme park in England, the 10th most visited in Europe, and it's not right in the centre of the town, but it's not all that far out. You can get a bus there very quickly. It was built in 1996. It was the second Legoland to be built after the one in Denmark, the original one. It was built on the site of the old Windsor Safari Park, which I think... Did you say you've been there once?
Oh, I went to the Windsor Safari Park.
Must have been a very long time.
I'm that old. Yes. I think I was about 4 years old.
Well, you know, it still has one remnant from those old zoo days. It still has the hill train. I don't know if you'll remember going up and down that, but that's still there, going up and down the steep hill. Another old remnant, the safari park itself was built in the grounds of St. Leonard's Mansion, which is a former circus and actually a former residence of JFK, John Kennedy's father, during the Second World War, who at the time was the American ambassador to the UK and had use of the house. And that house is still standing. I think it's been used as the Legoland to HQ, but now is a corporate events and a wedding venue. So you could get married effectively in Legoland's grounds if you really wanted to.
Everyone loves a bit of Lego.
Absolutely. Expensive, but fun when you do it.
So let's talk a bit about literature. There's obviously a very famous Shakespeare play set in Windsor.
Yep, it's inspired in some way a few literary works. As you say, Shakespeare famously wrote The Merry Wives of Windsor, which was set in the town, partly in the Great Park, where a tree called Falstaff's Oak used to stand, named after Falstaff, one of the stars of the play. The play isn't particularly well thought of among Shakespeare's canon, but it has inspired more than 10 operas by Verdi, by Vaughan Williams, and also by Salieri, who is probably more famous as the baddie from the film Amadeus than he is for his own music, unfortunately for him. Also, William Harrison Ainsworth, perhaps a bit less famously, published the historical novel Windsor Castle in the 1840s about Henry VIII's abandonment of Catherine of Aragon for Anne Boleyn, which we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. And one final thing I'm going to talk about is a gastronomic point. It's the delicious pudding, Eton Mess, if any listeners haven't ever had one, is made of berries, whipped cream and meringue all mushed up and mixed together. It's a bit like the Scottish Cranachan and is
absolutely wonderful. And no one quite knows the origins of the pudding. One theory is that a dog at an Eton College cricket match trampled a pavlova and the players just decided to eat it anyway, in the big mess that it was. But it does certainly have a strong connection with Eton College. It's served at all the school's cricket matches, and I strongly urge you, if you've never had one, do have it.
All right, so let's go on to the scores.
One of the things we always look at in summing up towns is what has happened here which changed the country, changed the world, which had a great influence beyond the town's borders. And I think having a key influence in the development of football could hardly be more impressive in that respect. For balance, Eton didn't act alone in the formation of football, of course. It has been suggested that actually the public school influence in football has been a bit overplayed, and this was more just kind of a short-lived historical aberration, and that the original mass folk versions of football and this narrative continuation into the modern version of football as the working class people's game, the more authentic narrative of the sport's development. But I think this relies on a pretty subjective interpretation of what the sport of football was and is. And it really isn't fair to ignore the enormous progress that was made in the organisation of codification of the sport compared with the centuries before. Allied with all the other points we've got, I think that means it has to be a positive score here. So I'm going to give Windsor and Eton a 7.
I suppose the only drawback for me is I don't really feel in any way when I was in Eton, I didn't feel this sense of it being so influential in football. Not much of a ongoing legacy of that, as far as I can tell, within the town itself. I mean, football is better celebrated in towns like Preston or London. It doesn't really feel like it's a big deal in Eton. The Eton Dorney facility is still there, and we've got good memories of the 2012 Olympics. But to me, I can't think of much more that sort of left the town that I feel is profound and celebrated. So for me, it's a 5.
Just one thing I'll add on what's there today. You're right, there's no statue, monument, museum or anything like that. But there is an intangible cultural legacy. You still have the Eton Wall game played today. You still have the closely yes. related Eton Field game. I don't know how easy it is for a member of the public to go and watch it, but it's still there. It's still unique. So there's a small thing there. But yeah, overall, that's a 12 out of 20. Nice. So yeah, positive
score. Not a bad score.
No?
Not bad at all.
Better than I might have expected, actually, before we started researching this.
Our fourth category is urban landscape. Now, Windsor is undoubtedly a beautiful small town, but it's really dominated by the enormous castle and the castle buildings and the castle structures associated with the castle. So let's start there.
The castle was probably built on its present site because it sits on a defensible chalk ridge and is protected by the River Thames on one side, with the river itself a quite an important transport route to London at the time. The location actually helped quite a lot in the construction of the castle, as the Thames was the main means by which supplies and materials were brought into the area for the building works. The castle was actually built as part of a large ring of post-conquest forts built all around London, each of them about a day's travel apart, to control that area around the capital. You can actually see a depiction of one of those forts being built on the Bayeux Tapestry. But of all the forts built, only the Tower of London and Windsor constitute anything more than a set of ruins today. The castle is built to a great extent of Reigate stone, which was mined from nearby Surrey, where the town of Reigate is, and is the same material, cut from exactly the same place, used in construction at Westminster Abbey. But the castle was extensively remodelled in the 14th century by King Edward III. By some measures, it was the largest non-religious building project in England in the Middle Ages. And all of the work certainly brought a huge amount of money, trade and bustle to the town. Actually, Geoffrey Chaucer, author of the Canterbury Tales, was a building foreman during the construction. St George's Chapel is a very important part of the castle complex, and its construction was started by Henry III as a chapel dedicated to Edward the Confessor, but rebuilt from 1475 to 1528 in the Perpendicular Gothic style, which we talked about in our episode on Bath quite a lot. State banquets are often held in the chapel, and it can take 2 days to lay the table for one of these, grand occasions as they are. The whole castle was very nearly sold off after the Civil War, but it was retained for Oliver Cromwell's use. It was pretty much abandoned as a royal residence by the early Georgian monarchs, but it underwent significant redevelopment under George IV, which included raising the round tower by about 10 metres to improve the skyline, which does mean you can see the tower for miles around even today. And there's an especially good view when you approach the Windsor Central Station from Slough. And there was also some concurrent Regency development in the grand houses on Park Street in Windsor, which remained from around this time. They were designed by John Nash, who famously designed Regent Street in central London. But despite all this redevelopment, all of the adding to and the tweaking of the castle complex, you can still see parts of the original stone building today. For instance, the curfew tower, which you can easily see from outside on the street. Don't even need to pay to go in. And it has an impressive Stuart era clock on the top.
So I think what really strikes you about the castle when you see it from a distance, but also when you're approaching it and you're coming into it and within it, is these different stages of development. And even though much of the, or pretty much all of the original castle will be gone, the layout, which was the Motte double bailey construction, still lives on with the different sections of the castle, the upper ward, the lower ward. And what you also see in these waves of construction is the different motivations for the refurbishment or construction. Some defensive, you mentioned subsidence, some aesthetic. And it leaves you with a very interesting building that takes you through the eras of English life. I read that parts of Reading Abbey were used in one of the remodelings.
Oh, wow.
Presumably after the Reformation. Nearby, I suppose. So, and we know we talked about the destruction of Reading Abbey in the Reading episode. And then what you see today is you see some of the refurbishments that were done in more modern history. The Georgian, you mentioned, Nash. And then, but even in the 20th century. And of course, the incident that I remember, a very major historical incident that you'll remember as well, was the fire at Windsor Castle in 1992, which was,
of course,
during refurbishment. There isn't a century where you couldn't associate some major building work at Windsor Castle, and you can see that in the building. We have spoken a lot about the castle, but let's talk a bit more about the architecture of the town around the castle. And historically, the town has really hugged right on the side of the castle. And although some of that's been cleared, you still have that sense when you're there that you're just outside the castle. Should we talk about some of those buildings?
It's probably worth going right back to the beginning about how New Windsor, or Windsor as it is now, came to be outside the castle. We talked earlier about how it grew up in a different place from the original Old Windsor, and the castle was crucial to its foundation as the town grew around the castle from when the castle was rebuilt in stone and therefore firmly established in the early 12th century. And buildings were in fact still clinging to the outside of the castle's walls well into the 19th century. There's some evidence of how connected the two were. The town at this point in the 12th century was really confined to the small area between High Street, Castle Hill and St Albans Street. But the population and trade would have started to grow even just during the castle construction work. Local farmers probably have sold food and other supplies to the workmen and soldiers here, and been very tempted to move their trade here, given the extra protection that a royal castle offered. There was some deliberate town planning that followed, with construction of new facilities like a church, a marketplace centred around where the current Queen Victoria statue is, and a hospital. The street pattern did change a little bit throughout the years, and the layout of the old central area was more or less fixed by the early 17th century, but you can still see elements of this original medieval planning in the town's present-day street plan, in that Thames Street follows this medieval plan from Windsor Bridge to Cambridge Gate. One other notable point about the streets of Windsor is Queen Charlotte Street, which claims in a wall plaque to be the shortest street in Britain at 51 feet and 10 inches long. I've seen this claim made more than once, though. I've been to Ebenezer Place in Wick, which is much shorter and also makes the claim. So it's probably really a question of definition, as Queen Charlotte Street is no doubt a street. Ebenezer Place is really just a short path in front of a building. So however you define it.
Yeah, I'm always a bit suspicious of the smallest something.
Yeah.
The smallest window in Hull. I mean, I don't know how you ever prove.
Well, I have a peephole in my front door, which is smaller than that. Talking about some of the buildings, as you mentioned.
Yes.
I think Central Station, Windsor Eaton Central Station, is definitely something to look at first. This is just over the road from the castle. It was used by royalty. It was the royal station from its construction in the 1840s. And it had a royal waiting room added in 1897 for the Diamond Jubilee. Though, to be honest, I can't imagine Queen Victoria ever being prepared to wait around a station for a train. So I doubt it ever saw any of its intended use. Session site has an interesting history. It was actually built on the location of a red light district. And one historian I read claims that the choice of location was made specifically to stamp out prostitution in that area, which would have been carried on right next to the castle. But more generally, it certainly is true to say that this grand royal facade of Windsor in the 18th and 19th centuries, before the railways came, did belie a much more squalid and overcrowded town that the ordinary citizens had to suffer before its later suburban expansion. Jonathan Swift said about Windsor, it was had a delightful situation, but the town is a scoundrel. And one report in 1838 showed that only 58% of children born in the town could expect to live to 15 years old. So it really was a town of contrasting extremes at this time. But back to the station itself, there was an assassination attempt on Queen Victoria there when she arrived in 1882, quite famously. This was the last of eight such attempts to kill her. The chap who fired at her, according to contemporary reports, fired real bullets, not blanks, which had been used in other assassination attempts, was found insane at trial and was wrestled to the ground by two local schoolboys. I'm sure had a great hero's welcome when they got back to school. The station buildings have been very, very well preserved. Even when the station itself was cut back to just one small platform, as it is today, the buildings remained. Initially in the 1980s, it was converted to an exhibition on royalty and railways run by Madame Tussauds. But today it contains lots of very posh shops and restaurants. And only the steam engine has been preserved from the old exhibition on a very small disused section of track, mainly because it was just too heavy to get rid of. If you want to see how the station looked before it was closed and repurposed, I suggest watching the old British comedy Carry On Loving, where Sid James skulks all around Central Station while he's being trailed by Charles Hawtrey. Windsor was very close to lots of old British film studios, so you'll see lots of old British comedies in the 50s, 60s, 70s filmed at the station. But this is a notable film because being stalked all around the station means you get to see all the nooks and crannies of it and in colour. And just one final interesting point about the station. It was officially on the London Underground for a short time. District line trains used to come here from 1883 to 1885. But if you want to go there now, you have to change at Slough. But it's a very short branch journey, so it doesn't take too long.
Direct train to Farringdon it was. It wasn't financially viable. But it's not too bad because Windsor's actually got two stations and two railway lines, and I believe it's because the competing railway companies wanted to see who could be the first to carry the Queen to Windsor.
Well, both stations were opened the same year, weren't they, in the 1840s? So I'm not sure who won, but whoever did didn't win by very, very much time.
But you're absolutely right, the restoration of Central Station is quite extraordinary, and it's well worth a look. And a credit to Windsor, because you've got many towns had their rail services cut back in the Beeching era, and not all did so well with their station buildings, but Windsor has certainly done a magnificent job. Let's talk quickly about some of the other buildings in the town, and one that really sticks out for me, I really enjoyed, was the Guildhall.
The Guildhall is Windsor's town hall. It was built at the end of the 17th century by Christopher Wren, who actually took over from an earlier architect, Thomas Fitz, who died 2 years into the Guildhall's construction. It's a notable part of the post-Commonwealth restoration era revival of the town, which saw a lot of the town's buildings transformed from medieval timber to brick or just built anew from brick. When you see it, there's a quite striking open area in front of you below the upper floor where corn markets used to be held. Another very notable thing about this open area is that there are lots of pillars there holding up the upper floor, but quite famously, some of those pillars are entirely superficial. They don't actually touch the ceiling, so aren't needed for any structural purpose at all. Their use is aesthetic rather than practical. And the legend is that Christopher Wren, when asked to add more pillars, wanted to prove, showing off slightly, that they weren't necessary by adding this small gap of a few centimetres between the pillars and the ceiling. Unfortunately, there's no evidence for this story, but there's no question that the gap is there. We saw it ourselves. In more recent times, the Guildhall hosted Prince Charles's second wedding in 2005 to Camilla Parker Bowles. The reason it was held there rather than Windsor Castle was because the wedding was a civil service, and if Windsor Castle had hosted a civil wedding, then technically anyone else could have asked to be married there at any point in the next 3 years. So rather than letting anyone turn up and use Windsor Castle for their wedding, as fun as it would have been, they decided to move it just outside the walls into the Guildhall.
Right, makes sense. I wonder if they produced any celebratory cheese cutters.
We should have looked.
That wedding. Should have looked. Just around the corner. I mean, this is a great little collection of buildings, by the way, around the Guildhall and right next to the castle. And it's all fantastic around there. You've also got the Crooked House.
We do. Another nearby building which attracts the photos, which, as you'd expect, is famous for how much it leans over. And it leans so much simply because the house is too tall for the construction techniques that were used. And it looks pretty ancient, but actually isn't as old as you might think. It was built in the 18th century, originally as a butcher's shop, but still, it catches the eye when you're there.
And then going a bit out of the town, the oldest building, I think we're only mentioning this for one reason. Let's talk about St. Andrew's Church.
St. Andrew's Church in Clure is the oldest building in Windsor. We have to get out of the town centre a bit and walk over there. Clure was originally a separate, much older settlement than Windsor, but it's long since been subsumed by the suburban creep of its neighbour. The church is mostly Norman or a 19th century rebuild by Gilbert Scott, but there is an original Saxon font and some parts of the walls are from the original Saxon building as well. It's also where Daniel Gooch, the great railway engineer who, talking about Venn diagrams, we always seem to end up discussing for some reason I can't quite fathom, was buried after he died in 1889, having lived in Clure from 1859. I would say it was disconcerting seeing my name on this large memorial, but to be honest, we've covered him so much and seen his name in so many museums that I'm pretty used to it now.
It's a bit of a pilgrimage for railway buffs, isn't it? And I mean, he built some housing there as well. And it's not a bad walk out to Clure, actually. There's some nice, there's a nice brewery on the way.
Yep, you know, Windsor Brewery.
Stop halfway to Clure. But we need to talk about what happens when you cross over the River Thames and you come into Eton.
Absolutely. Eton's town centre is much smaller than Windsor's, as you expect from its population. It's built around a high street that runs north from that Windsor Bridge between various buildings, mainly from the 17th century, which mostly contain hotels, pubs, restaurants, and goes up through Eton College's buildings towards Slough, to the north. Probably the one building that is most famous, most grand and most known in Eton is the chapel of Eton College. It was originally planned to be absolutely enormous, specifically in order to overshadow St. George's Chapel in Windsor Castle. But the plans were changed to something a bit more modest when Henry VI, who, as we mentioned, founded Eton College, had one of his recurrent bouts of mental illness, and the construction of the chapel was taken over by someone else. Two of the most notable features in the chapel are the restored wall paintings and the massive fan-vaulted roof. These wall paintings come from the 15th century, but the fan-vaulted roof is much more recent. It looks ancient and medieval, but it was actually built in the 1950s to replace the former wooden roof. And in recent years, the chapel and school have been used as a filming location in some pretty notable films. Three examples, all Oscar winners, are Shakespeare in Love, Chariots of Fire, and The Madness of King George. So it continues to have, you know, aesthetic merit for modern artistic endeavours as well as its own architectural merits.
One final building to mention in Eton.
Oh yes, the cockpit. The cockpit. We can note this. This was until recently a restaurant. I think it's now being converted into housing. It was built in the early 15th century with, not surprisingly, a cockpit in the back garden. One interesting point about it is it had a knucklebone floor in the pit, which helped with the cock's grip. So another remnant of a pretty ghastly old blood sport there.
We've mentioned that it's well worth taking a walk through to Eton and through to the college, but there's some other wonderful walks you can do as well coming out of Windsor with some spectacular views. And I think, first and foremost, let's mention the Great Park.
We should, yes. Windsor Great Park is a royal park. It's part of Windsor Forest and the scene of many royal tournaments in the Middle Ages. We say forest, that might sound surprising if you see it, but royal forests initially weren't just areas covered in trees. Only, in fact, a fifth of medieval forests were woodland, but they were simply areas of land governed by forest law, so not within the normal common law of the land in some respects, such as the right to hunt game. The forests mainly were there to provide pasture land for certain animals, normally for the monarch's benefit, and so it was for Windsor Great Park. The park's been featured in lots of films, including some opening shots of Carry On Henry, another Carry On mentioned there. Again, film studios were nearby. And on the cover of Elton John's 1978 album A Single Man, there's a photo of him standing there. Standing at the Long Walk is a very famous part of the Great Park. It's an enormous length of parkland that runs 3 miles completely dead straight from the castle gates up to a colossal statue of George III in Roman dress at the other end on a huge 26-foot granite pedestal. Now, the walk was created at about the same time that Wren built the Guildhall as part of a kind of unified grand Baroque remodelling plan for parts of the town. It takes about 45 minutes to walk each direction at a gentle walking pace. And it's a pretty stunning view because of how straight it is and how clear it is. You can see the miles to each end from the other or at any point along the walk. So definitely something people will do if they go to Windsor and have the stamina for it.
Very impressive vista of the castle, terminating the lovely cherry and plane trees that are laid out there. So my scores, I'll go first on this one. I think Windsor Castle is pretty much unbeatable, not just the scale of the building itself, but also the way it looms over the town. It looms over the Thames and then the town kind of comes up a hill beside it. And this gives you some really dramatic views. You've got the great views from the Long Walk. So I think the setting of the town around the castle is absolutely fantastic. Wonderful walks that you can do from the town down to Eton through Eton High Street with its collection of 17th century buildings over to the college. I think the only thing that it's lacking for me is that it sort of comes to an end pretty quickly and it's not got that sort of medieval atmosphere you might associate with some towns. It's so steeped in history. However, the railway station is very well preserved. Wonderful preservation of buildings like the Guildhall and that area around. So I have to give a good score here. I'm going to give it 7.5.
It's quite interesting, as you said earlier, to follow Hull with Windsor because they are kind of like the opposite of each other in many ways. Windsor is well known right on the tourist trail. In many of its best known areas, very pretty. Not that Hull didn't have its great areas as well, as we found out. The castle is absolutely great, as you rightly said. To balance this grandeur, though, the streets of Windsor Town Centre perhaps aren't as interesting as other towns that we've seen. They're not as antiquated or labyrinthine as other ancient centres like, say, York or Chester, but they're also not as grand as Georgian centres like Bath. And to be honest, you can, as you kind of hinted at, finish the old parts of the town centre quite quickly. And a lot of the area around the core of Windsor and Eton is fairly, you know, run-of-the-mill residential areas or modern or 20th century redevelopment. The exception to that, the very obvious exception, would be Eton College, if you can get in there. But you go through Eton quickly and you come up on the road up to Slough. It's also a real shame that that Royalty and Railways exhibition, the station, closed 30 years ago, because it looks excellent when you see videos of it on YouTube. It depicted in full scale the full pageantry of Queen Victoria arriving at Windsor. And I'm sure that, you know, posh soap shops and branches of ZZ have their place, but I know which I'd rather visit in the station. So for me, it's a good score. It's going to be a 6 from me.
Well, we're coming up now to our final category. We've visited Windsor, we've spoken about Windsor at length, but the question is, did it beat our expectations?
First thing to say is expectations are very, very high for someone like Windsor. Very high indeed. So it's already got a bit of a fight on its hands. So much has happened here simply in the castle. This can't be a terrible score, even if you were expecting it to some extent. But we all know that Windsor is an important royal centre. So the question really is, how does the rest of it do? But my criticism would be that everyone goes to Windsor and Eton. It's a real tourist trap. But you can end up finishing the towns, seeing everything you want to see quite quickly. You would spend maybe 2 or 3 hours in the castle, another few wandering the streets. You could do the long walk or walk around the parks if you want to, if that's your thing. That may well be it, though. I don't think you're going to get more than a day at most out of a trip to Windsor and Eton, unless you add on a trip to Legoland or perhaps a short boat trip on the Thames, although I don't think there's anything particularly interesting to see on the river there. For that reason, the history of the town itself probably comes up to par with my expectations. The experience of the town beyond the castle, well, it's definitely worth visiting for a day, perhaps doesn't quite. So for me, it's going to be 4.5.
Yeah, I agree with that analysis. Now, there's things I've learned from this podcast episode that have been really enjoyable for me, and particularly the sport around Eton, royal history at the castle and the development of the castle. I went into the episode thinking, well, it's a relatively small town. How much can there be to see? So in some ways, that reputation that you speak about, for me, that was already tempered by its size to an extent. But yes, agree that it's not vast amounts beyond the buildings we've mentioned and its prettiness. And do you know what, actually? I think I'd like more explicit celebration of all that military history. I feel that might have got lost under the prettiness, the nice restaurants, the nice shops. Would be nice to have a bit more on that. So for me, it's going to be a 4.
So overall, Windsor and Eton have got a very impressive 18 out of 20 for politics and war, 3.5 out of 20 for science and industry, 12 out of 20 for art and culture, 13.5 out of 20 for urban landscape, and 8.5 out of 20 for reality versus expectations, which is a total of 55.5 out of 100 overall. And we always work to 5 as the average score. So that's still a positive score. And I don't want people to be put off going to the place by our summing up reality versus expectations. Expectations are high for a reason. There are good reasons people visit this place. So absolutely feel encouraged to do so.
Well, that's all we have time for today, and we hope you enjoyed our little tour of Windsor and Eton, and please let us know what you thought of the episode. Whether you give us a royal warrant for our performance, or would rather leave us standing like a naughty schoolboy, we'd love to know. So please get in touch via eoldieguide.com. Goes without saying, but I'm saying it again, please give us a rating or review on your podcast provider. Now, for our next episode, we're heading north to a town of many industries. We're going to Warrington. We hope you can join us. Bye for now.